The Real Estate Talk Podcast, Season 2, with Robert Keilman and Joshua Britt.
That's correct.
Featuring topics about real estate nobody is talking about.
And it's your expertise on it.
The Real Estate Talk Podcast starts now.
All right, Real Estate Talk Podcast, Season 2. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, as we get back into this newest episode. Got an interview today with Mr. Chris Graff, attorney, CPA, specializing in small service businesses. Over 30 years of experience. Get to pick his brain for a while. Stay tuned. And as always, this episode is sponsored by Closer Coffee Company. Fresh roasted coffee for closers by closers. Fuel your hustle at closercoffeeco.com. And welcome back to another Real Estate Talk Podcast. Rob Keilman.
Joshua Britt.
All right. Thanks for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We have a very special guest on today. We have Mr. Chris Graff. He is attorney and CPA specializing in small service businesses with over 30 years of experience. Chris, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate you having me.
All right, man. So look, when I started looking into some of your specialties, and I looked at something called life cycle management and stuff, but we'll get into that later. But how did you get into small businesses and whatnot? What got you excited about doing that?
Well, my first and only job that I ever started that I'm continuing to do today was to be a small medical practice business consultant. And there were, back when I started, there were most medical practices were private practices. And the structures were anywhere from one to maybe 15, 20 physicians at a time. And my partner at the time, still partner actually, and I would go visit our clients every month, about 80 clients, drive to the offices.
Sounds like a lot of driving for 80 clients.
It was a lot of driving, 30, 35,000 miles a year on the car.
Oh, wow.
But that was in the old days before the internet and all that fun stuff that we have now.
Is that a write-off now because you're a CPA?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, write everything off, right?
Right.
But we would meet and discuss financials with our clients and prepare tax returns. And since I'm an attorney as well, I would handle a lot of ancillary things similar to an in-house counsel. I would write the contracts, review contracts, set up, corporations, limited liability companies, and help the buy-sell agreements. And when you get to the more difficult component of the business, which is the succession planning, we do a lot of that too. You know, bring in new docs, get old docs out on their way and in good order into retirement, and try to maintain and grow the health of the businesses. And over years, as medicine changed, more and more of the practices got out of the private sphere, and most doctors nowadays are hired by hospitals and are employees. So we expanded into a lot of other service businesses as a result of that. And businesses like real estate fall squarely within that parameter. So,
okay. So, would you say that there's less of those smaller practices around? They're more like bigger hospitals or chains or something like that?
Yeah, you see a lot of hospital organizations now that manage most of the physicians in terms of employment, and a lot of larger groups because they have to try to negotiate insurance, reimbursements with large insurance companies. So the bigger you are, the better. And there is still a pretty thriving community of cash-based practices, like the concierge practices, where they just get out of the insurance business altogether, and they do quite well in that, as small businesses and thrive. Now, a lot of them are now selling out to private equity and getting out of the game, but there's just a whole spectrum of stuff out there still.
So how does this kind of transition? I know you start off with the medical side. Yeah. How did that transition into real estate for you?
So most of the private practices owned their own practices. So they owned the buildings in separate, LLCs, and they were owner-occupied. So we were doing a lot of partnership returns for those clients. And a lot of physicians, let's face it, make pretty good money. So a lot of them would get into real estate on the side. So we were doing a lot of you know, real estate rental schedules, and they would finance flips because they had the cash to back that up.
Nice.
So that it was just a natural growth. And, you know, you run into a real estate magnate or two, you know, you end up with a lot of clients. And real estate's more fun. The doctors are rule followers. So they, you know, will go very conservatively on whatever advice you give them. Whereas real estate, most people tend to be a lot more aggressive and creative in their thinking. So it's fun. It's fun to get both sides of the coin.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
So, one of the things, so I guess my first question was life cycle. So I looked at it up online because I don't know anything about business life cycles. I think I learned that in grad school, but I forgot all about it.
Sure.
So starts off with you got the initiation of the business. And forgive me if I have all the the nomenclatures all wrong, but you have the startup and you have the growth cycle. You hit a period of maturity and then you have a period of decline and then failure. So I think a lot of small businesses don't know that, of what the life cycle is. They might have a kind of an idea of it, but how do you know? I mean, just based on your experience doing this for a while, how does a business know where they're at? Obviously, if you're making money, you're in the growth phase, right? But how do you know when you're plateauing? You're no longer growing anymore, and when you're on a decline? Because that could be too late, you know, by the time you know that.
Right, and that's why planning is so important. But by and large, what you're looking at are the financials. Mm-hmm. If right now, you know, we're going through a fairly it's actually kind of tailing off a little bit right now, but a lot of the private equity cycles where there are these purchases where they're trying to buy a number of similar businesses, package them up and sell them off to another group, you know, upstream to, you know, basically make money off them. But the evaluation process with the private equity firms when they're trying to purchase your business is they're going to look at the last at least 3 years tax returns that you have for the business and like a current P&L, and you just come up with, you know, numbers based on that, sustainable numbers.
Profits
based
and losses.
On EBITDA, right? Yeah, earnings before income taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And then they'll cash flow it. They'll say, look, you know, we think your business is worth five times your earnings, your annual earnings. So we'll borrow money ourselves or take, you know, money out of reserves, and we will pay you a big chunk of money right now to buy your business because we know it's going to cash flow and we'll get our money back in 3 to 5 years and then we're making profit after that.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can see the value in your business based on those financials by and large. And I deal with a lot of dental practices too, and they're a lot more, I'd say, fungible than like a medical practice. Medical practice, when you hang a shingle and you get onto an insurance panel, you've got instant patients. The minute you get off the insurance panel, they're gone. Mm. So there's almost no goodwill in a traditional medical practice anymore other than like furniture, fixtures, and equipment and accounts receivable. Dental practices are different because they've discovered that patients tend to keep coming back to the same locations no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the ones in our area, for example, they'll sell at 85 cents on the dollar. So if you bring in $1 million a year in receipts, you can sell it to another dentist under an asset purchase agreement. $850,000, boom, and it'll cash flow, and you'll make good money off it in just a few years. So there's a whole industry out there of dental practices that buy and sell each other. In fact, a lot of the dentists use that as their retirement platform, believe it or not.
Josh and I flip homes. Do some people flip dental practices?
Absolutely. They're transitional.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a guy right now that's buying a practice. He's 60. He shouldn't be doing that probably, but if he can flip it in 10 years, you know, then he's going to get all long-term capital gains treatment on whatever, $1 million that he gets paid.
Hmm.
So it's a pretty good gig.
That sounds good. So what you got, Joshua?
I went out and just, you know, kind of asked the question to AI, like, hey, if you were going to interview a CPA, what were some of the top questions that people would want to know? Like, where does the Google search say people are asking for? So, like, the very number one question that was asked the most was, how can I minimize my tax liability? And I'm sure that's a very high question that gets asked in Google.
Yeah.
For sure. It's a one-word answer, right? No. The unfortunate reality is that if you're making money, you're going to be paying taxes. The bigger question is, you know, how you can, you know, manage your tax rate, because you've got the, you know, various brackets. You know, everybody who, you know, if you make $1 million versus $100,000, you're paying 10% on the first bracket of taxes. And then, you know, the more money you make, the higher brackets you creep into, and you pay higher rates on those brackets. And unfortunately, the worst way to make money is through W-2 wages, because not only do you have federal and state income taxes that you have to contend with for, you know, your withholdings to cover the taxes that you, you know, are going to have to pay on your earnings, but you've also got FICA taxes. That's Social Security and Medicare tax together. It's 7.65%. The Social Security tax, the big one, is 6.2%, but it caps off at right now at about $170,000. That the number's indexed, but the Medicare tax goes on forever. So if you make $2 million on your W-2, you're paying the Medicare tax of 1.45%. And after, I think it's $250,000, there's a, I call it the Obamacare tax, but there's a basically a healthcare tax on top of that for another, like, you know, whatever, 2.2%, something to that effect. So, you know, the W-2 is the worst way to make money. Mm. So what most people try to do is convert their income into the equivalent of long-term capital gains, because you get much better tax rate treatments to get that money into your pocket in post-tax dollars.
So are there any strategies that anyone should be trying to use in order to reduce the amount of taxes that are owed?
Yeah, sure. So, like, if you're a real estate professional, you're generally going to have more than one stream of income. You know, most folks will have, you know, the real estate commissions, but they'll also potentially have a side business where they're flipping houses, because they're in the driver's seat to find good deals, right?
Yep.
And then, you know, if you're also, you know, you've got some rentals you might have. So if you're an active real estate professional, it's pretty favorable in the tax code, because you can take losses against your income to the extent that you have them. Whereas if you're not a real estate professional, which is got to be really your primary job. Like, you can't be a full-time doctor and be a real estate professional too. The IRS won't allow that. Mm. But if you're doing at least 750 hours a year in real estate, you got to have fairly good documentation to back it up, because it is, again, a pretty generous area of the tax code. But you can take losses on your rental properties. You know, if you lose money on the flips, that all comes, you know, off the top of your adjusted gross income on your 1040. So a lot of favorable advantages to that. As far as trying to, like, get the right structure, though, there's two things that you really need to be aware of that really a lot of people can't seem to understand. Like, they'll come to me and say, hey, Chris, you know, I don't know, should I be an LLC or an S-corporation?
Hold on a second. That's coming up. It's a little bit further down the list here. But
all right, I can wait.
Yeah, let's hold off on that. But let's Fair go enough. To question number two. But question one was answered superbly. Question number two is what are the tax implications of selling my home or investment property? And do you have any guidance on potential capital gains taxes or other considerations?
Yeah, so first we got to determine the purpose of the home. Are we talking a principal residence, or are we talking a second home, or are we talking a business investment or an active business? If it's a personal residence, as long as you've been living in that house as your primary residence for two of the last 5 years, you can exclude up to $250,000 of gain. Exclude, no tax, no nothing, per spouse. So it can be up to $500,000 that you can exclude. And as a side note, a lot of times, you know, when you're selling something like a house, it's because somebody's passed away, a spouse, something to that effect. Don't forget, there's also stepped up basis rules. So if when you pass away, your value of your assets, when it passes on to other people, they get to take that at zero basis again. So, like, let's say, for example, you had a house that was worth $300,000 when you bought it. So you bought it for $300,000, and when you died, it was worth $500,000, and you pass it on to your spouse or your children, their cost basis is $500,000 now. So if they sell it for $550,000, they don't have to pay the capital gains between $300,000 and $550,000. It's just that $50,000 in gain. So,
Oh, nice.
Yes. So that's the personal residence exclusion. And actually, you'll see a lot of construction folks that, you know, people that are contractors, basically, you know, they'll buy fixer-uppers in nice neighborhoods and they'll live in them for 3 years. And they've got all their subcontractors fixing the house up and making improvements to it while they're living there. And then they go sell it for $400,000 or $500,000 more than they bought it. And they move on to the next house. So you won't often have contractors living in your neighborhood for a long period of time because that's what they're doing. They're getting all that free money moving from one place to the next. So the next real estate opportunity is going to be an investment property. Let's say you have a second house or you have a vacation home or something like that. That's not subject to that exclusion. So you are going to be paying capital gains. If you flip and you sell in less than a year, then you're paying whatever your ordinary income tax rate is. So remember, that's bracketized. So, you know, even if you're paying an average of 25 cents on the dollar to the feds for your normal taxes from all your earnings, you know, you could still be, you know, in the 32% tax bracket because of this flip where you made all this money. So that, you know, is going to be an ordinary income. If you can hold on to that property for at least 1 year, all of a sudden, you're automatically into long-term capital gains. And for the first two tax brackets, the 10 and the 15% tax bracket, long-term capital gains rate is zero, which is awesome. For everybody else, and again, these numbers are indexed, and I've been doing this so long, I can't remember exactly what the indices are, but the next level of tax for long-term capital gains rates is 15%. And then when you get over a certain amount, I think it's like $600,000 or $700,000 now, based on whatever your total earnings are, it'll jump up to 20%. But that Obamacare tax I was telling you about earlier, they tack on another 3.8%. So you're really looking at 23.8% for long-term capital gains taxes if you make enough money. And then you've got state tax you got to worry about too. And the state doesn't distinguish between any kind of earnings. They don't care if it was, you know, interest, dividends, passive activity, whatever it was, they tax everything at the regular state rate. And in Virginia right now, it's 5.75%.
So curious, out of all that, all those types of real estate transactions where somebody would be using as an investment, from the tax perspective, what would you, if you were doing it yourself, what would you recommend to somebody else?
Well, one of the first recommendations I make, because, you know, a lot of these businesses are asking us to, you know, help them, you know, make these long-term determinations.
Yeah.
And for me, I say, look, if, you know, you're going to have an owner-occupied building, you want to make sure that you're going to be in that building for 10 years. Hmm. Why? Because when we had the collapse back in 2007 and 2008, I had a client out in Nagsa that built a building at that time, right at the peak. And it took 10 years for him to get back into the black. Hmm. And that's the worst scenario that we've had in my lifetime. So if you're going to be, as a rule of thumb, in a building, owner-occupied building for 10 years plus, you're going to at least get your money back on it. So that's, you know, from an investment standpoint. When you're doing the active real estate, like, you know, like you all do, from at least from our, you know, brief discussions, that's a whole different world, because you guys have the eyes out for what, you know, good deals are. And if you can make, you know, fast money on some of those just because of your knowledge of the marketplace, you know, as long, at least in my mind, as you hold that property for a year, you're going to be able to get better tax rates on it.
Hmm. We've been doing
so. Don't flip it too fast. That's right. Don't flip too fast.
But it costs more if we wait too long.
It does. But you'll see a lot of people, though, will chain them up and have several flips going so that they can cash in different years. Because remember, each tax year is its own, like, encapsulation. So January, whatever money hits your bank, because we're all cash basis taxpayers, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So whatever money hits your bank between January 1 and December 31 of any year, that's what the IRS taxes you on, and that's where your tax bracket, you know, goes up to. And if you can structure your flips so that you're, you know, flipping one or two or four at a time, you know, each year versus doing it all in 1 year, you can spread that tax hit out a good bit. And that's a big deal.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right. So now we get into that question that you wanted to answer earlier. So how should I structure my new business for tax efficiency? That's the question. And any advice that you can provide on choosing between sole proprietorship, partnership, LLC, S-Corp or C-Corp?
Okay, so we have to have two separate conversations here. The first conversation is, you know, what structure you're going to use in your state. you can either not set up a structure at all, and then you're either going to be a Schedule C sole proprietor, or you're going to be, you know, have a real estate activity for a Schedule E. And beyond that, if you're going to set up an artificial entity, which is going to either be a corporation or a limited liability company, you have to understand that that is a state-governed entity. So if you set one up in Virginia, whether it's a corporation or an LLC, and quite frankly, most people don't set up corporations anymore because they have archaic, you know, requirements where you have to keep annual corporate minutes to keep the from piercing the corporate veil, that kind of deal. Whereas with an LLC, it's a newer entity. In fact, the first one in the United States was set up in Wyoming back in like 1979. So they're really fairly recent from a case law standpoint. But once you set up your LLC in Virginia and you sign off on your organizational minutes and your operating agreement, you've completed the formation process. You don't have to do minutes anymore. You can just pay your $50 to the state once a year and you're good to go. But what does that do for you? You basically, once you get your federal identification number for that entity, you have set up an artificial person with an artificial Social Security number in Virginia. And all that does is protect you contractually and from tort law, accident injuries, slip and fall, that kind of stuff, from that particular business activity. So if you've got a rental house and you've got it in an LLC and, you know, a big party, you know, from the people that are renting from you, you know, they collapse the deck and people get hurt. As long as you've got that LLC set up and you signed, you know, your lease agreement with these people as the manager or the president of your limited liability company, if that thing blows up and there's $5 million worth of liability, you can just deep six or terminate the LLC at some point or bankrupt it, and they can't touch your other personal assets. So you're almost siloing those activities, those liabilities from the rest of your resources, which is a good thing because lawyers are really good at finding money.
So, they sure are.
But
that's the NAR.
Right. So we won't even talk about corporation. We'll just talk about LLCs at this point because they're inexpensive to run and operate and maintain. And again, you know, $50 a year, not a big deal to keep it going. But when you set that up, what does the IRS do to view that? Like, what do they think about this? It doesn't matter to them. The IRS is completely agnostic. They say, look, you set up an LLC as a one-person LLC, your default structure is going to be either a Schedule C or a Schedule E, depending on your activity, or Schedule F if you're doing a farm. You know, there's some other things there, but we'll stick to the basics. The next default entity is if there are more than one of you that set up the LLC, you're going to be in a partnership. And it doesn't matter whether it's two people without an LLC or two people with an LLC. That's just the default structure. And now you're going to have to pay somebody to file a partnership return. So it's another fee. So you got to be aware of that. If you ever want to become an S corporation or a C corporation, that's where the IRS wants you to have that artificial entity set up at the state level. Because if you don't, you can't just be a sole proprietor and elect C corporate status. It's called check-the-box regulations, actually. So the IRS says, you tell us how you want to be taxed, and we're just going to expect you to file accordingly.
That's interesting, because I had an LLC because, you know, when I do real estate. And then I got an accountant, and he told me I get lower taxes if I was an S corp. So somehow he wrote a letter.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
The other important thing to remember about the LLC itself is that if you do operate another, well, two things. One, if you do decide, you know, living in Virginia, you got an LLC in Virginia and you want to operate now in North Carolina. Well, you're either going to have to file as a foreign entity operating in North Carolina.
Foreign entity.
Yes, I know it's weird. Or you have to set up a whole new LLC in North Carolina. Okay. So people don't do that, right? And the other mistake I see is that people will start rental properties and they'll have three rental properties in an LLC. You don't want to do that. You want LLCs in separate one activity per LLC. Okay. Because if something goes wrong in one rental house and you've got three of them in one LLC, you got a problem. Because now they can attach to the other assets that, you know, where there is money in that without, you know, having to be limited to that one place where the liability arose.
Yeah. So you put your other assets at risk.
Right.
By having it in the same LLC.
Right. Okay. So now back to the tax question. When you are a sole proprietor, when you are a partnership or an S corporation, you're what they call a pass-through entity. You, again, cash basis taxpayer. You bring in your money, you make $100,000, you spend $50,000 in tax deductible expenses. In all three cases, you're going to be, you know, you're going to have a $50,000 tax liability. The difference between the sole proprietor and the partnership, in partnership, you can do a lot of different things, and I don't want to get too much into that because we could spend a week doing going through that stuff.
Yeah.
But
the basics.
Yeah, but basically, if you're in an active trader business and it's a service business, all of your Schedule C profit, not the income, but the receipts minus the tax-deductible overhead expenses, are subject to self-employment taxes, and that's those FICA taxes. The problem when you have your own business is not when you're an employee, you know, you'll see that 7.65% come out on your W-2. What a lot of people don't know is your employer has to match that. So your true liability is 15.3%. It's actually 12.3% is a Schedule C, because you get to deduct the employer part. So it gets a little convoluted.
Okay.
And a partnership, the default is the same thing, unless it's a passive activity like a rental. An S corporation is a different animal. If you're already going to be having to file another tax return because you're a partnership, right? Then it's a pretty easy decision to go to an S corporation. Again, this is active trader business. You don't want to do it with a passive activity like real estate. Rental. Or
gotcha.
Yeah. Because with the S corporation, your income is actually your W-2 wages that you've derived from that business, plus or minus your S corporate profit. So under that $100,000 income scenario, if you have $50,000 of expenses, if you take no W-2 wages out for that year, and we'll talk about reasonable compensation in a minute, you're going to get a $50,000 K-1. If you take $25,000 out for W-2 wages, you're going to get a $25,000 K-1. And it doesn't matter if you've taken the money out of the business or not. The IRS says, what was the income minus the tax-deductible expenses during that year? And there's a drop-dead date of December 31st. So basically, that the beauty of the S-corporation is that that K-1 profit is not, again, subject to that FICA tax. So up to that $170,000 threshold of income, you're saving 15.3% on taxes. And anything above and beyond that, you're saving that 2.9% for the Medicare still. The problem comes in with the concept of reasonable compensation. I have real estate clients they'll make $100,000. So they'll bring in $200,000 and they'll spend $100,000 in tax deductible expenses. So they're really earning $100,000. Some people will take like a $10,000 salary and take $90,000 out as K-1 profit. And the question you have to ask yourself, and it's a super subjective answer, and I usually say, you know, you really need to pay yourself enough to pass the laugh test at the IRS. So if you're getting audited, and they're looking at you across the table, you can't say, well, yeah, I'd pay somebody $10,000 a year to do my job. So what you usually want to think of is what would I have to pay somebody that I'm hiring off the street to do this job? And if you just happen to do it exceptionally well, that's where your profit comes in, and you can justify that to the IRS. And by way of example, we have a lot of licensed clinical social worker clients, and if you are trying to hire them off the street, a lot you can generally afford them for anywhere from $40,000 to $60,000 a year W-2 wages. We have some clients that are exceptional producers and bring in maybe $100,000 to $120,000 of income available to them per year. So we will structure them to have a W-2 of $50,000. But if they are actually making $120,000, that's a $70,000 K-1 profit, and you're saving 15.3% on all that. Now, the downside is you're not paying money into the Social Security system, and that can bite you down the road one day.
Yeah, possibly. All right, man.
Yeah, because I think also for some people, you know, and we see this a lot as real estate agents, you know, you have contractors who, you know, they want to buy a house and then they go to buy a house, but they don't make enough income to qualify for the house. So I think taking too many deductions or that laughable income that you mentioned hurts you in the long run anyways.
It can. It can, for sure.
Okay, so the next one is, Can you help with retirement planning and tax strategies as a CPA? And then what are some tips on maximizing retirement savings and minimizing taxes on retirement income?
We need another week for this one as well.
Oh, man.
Yeah. All right, give us the short version.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me back up and give you one more bit of information first. When I start people out, and they want to be an LLC because, you know, it makes them look professional, and they think, well, at some point I want to make the S election. I say, you know, don't build a castle and wait for your fiefdom to show up, right? You want to make sure that your business is going to be successful first. So do the minimal investment, set up your LLC, be a Schedule C. Again, we're talking active trader business. And then when you start making decent money, then you make your S election, and then you're going to have to pay for that separate S corporate return. But also don't forget, if you're somebody who does not like to deal with a lot of bureaucracy, the Schedule C is not a bad thing. My legal practice is a Schedule C. I don't even have an LLC set up for it because I've got malpractice insurance to cover me, and it's basically a virtual law firm. Once you set up that S corporation, in addition to having to pay for the S corporation itself, well, you're also doing payroll now, and you've got either to hire a payroll company or you got to do all those payroll reports. So there's just more stuff involved with it. But there becomes that economic threshold where it makes sense to do it. Like, okay, I'm doing a job here where I should be getting paid off the street $60,000 a year, but I'm making $200 now. So let's go ahead and make that S election, and we're going to put up with that extra, you know, crap basically, because we, you know, we're going to save $15,000 in taxes. Yeah, so that's when it's a good time to do that. And now segueing into the retirement plan, once again with a Schedule C, you know, you can fund a SEP, for example, Simplified Employee Pension Plan, and it's supposed to be 25% of compensation. But with an S, I mean a Schedule C, you get a partial deduction for it. So you're really only able to put away 18 or 19% of whatever your profit is to max out that SEP. When you make that S election and you're only paying yourself $10,000, the SEP calculations of 25% of compensation are based on your W-2. So now you can only put away $2,500. Yeah, so there's a lot of back and forth on this. Yeah, but a SEP's a very nice, easy, simple, you know, inexpensive retirement plan.
So it's almost a double-edged sword to be that S corp.
It can be. It can be. I will tell you that probably 80% of my clients, and most of our clients are, you know, fairly successful, but they do end up being S corporations over time, because it is a pretty efficient way to do things. And again, you know, if you're making more money than the average Joe doing what you're doing, then you do save on those FICA taxes. But it does impact other things.
So, like, what would be, if you had to, over the many years of experience that you have, like, what advice could you give to somebody like, hey, once you hit this point, this is a good point of switching from the Schedule C to the S corp? Is there a formula or something that you use for that?
Nope. It's just in excess of reasonable compensation. And, again, some of my clients are very, very conservative about that. And other clients are very, very aggressive about it. Willing, you know, how much risk are you willing to take with the IRS?
I got a question. Trying to think if I was in your shoes, what would be my top three pet peeves that you see small businesses do? Because, I mean, we see that in real estate, like the common things that come up. You're like, oh, why are they doing that? You know, do you have any of those?
I could give you a lot, actually. one of the biggest problems is disorganization. It's really important to keep your business financials separate from your personal financials, because
no commingling.
No, because when you commingle, what's happening is you are running into tax or non-tax deductible expenses that you're not taking into account necessarily as you're operating day to day. And if you're trying to look at financials and understand them, as you're going along, you don't realize what's happening, because almost every business person, this is why nobody understands CPAs. CPAs look at this stuff from an income and expense standpoint, and that's not how real businesses work. Real businesses pay attention to cash flow. If your bank account's going up, you're doing all right and you're not worried. But if the bank account's going down, it's a problem. And now you're nervous about it. But if you're running a bunch of stuff through your business that's not tax deductible, well, your cash is going down, but you're not capturing the tax deductions. And then you have this big surprise at the end of the year, and you're like, my stupid CPA came up with all this extra income, and now I owe all these taxes. Hmm. So it's really important to keep those things as buckled down as you can. And that's a good reason to have your LLC, too, because you get your articles of organization, you get your operating agreement, and you get your federal ID number. You go down to the bank, they let you set up a business bank account, and then you just say, okay, all my income is going in there, and as a default, I'm going to set 30 to 40 cents aside for my income at the end of the year to cover my taxes, because if you're not a W-2 employee, you've got to make those quarterly estimated tax payments, and they're not fun. Because it's a big chunk of money going to what we all know to be nothing good. But at the same time, you know, you need to do that. Because once you start getting behind on your taxes, especially with these quarterly estimates, things can get really nasty very quickly.
Okay. So the next one is what deductions and credits are small businesses eligible for? Like, you know, if you look on any social media platform, you will see people making TikToks, Reels, whatever, and it basically says that you're your own business and you can determine what your expenses are. How accurate is a statement like that?
Not.
Yeah, it's probably dangerous.
Yeah, statement. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Really, what the rule of thumb is, if the expense is an ordinary and necessary expense reasonably related to your business, then you should qualify for deduction so long as you've got adequate documentation. When the IRS comes in to audit you, the first thing they're going to do is say, give us all your bank statements. And then they're going to say, every dollar that hit that bank account is income unless and until you can prove otherwise. Every dollar that's coming out of that bank account is non-tax deductible unless and until you can prove otherwise. So to me, it's important to try to stick to the basics and not chase your tail just to save taxes. A lot of people do whatever they can to save taxes. I've had clients put $50,000 into pay to the feds at the end of the year just so they can get a $50,000 refund in April. You know, just crazy things because they're so concerned about the taxes. My philosophy is, you know, you found something that you're good at and or that you like to do, and you need to focus on that as your business. All the rest of this stuff will take care of itself. And, you know, we all have different motivations for doing different things. Like for me, I'm tied to the billable hour. So I go through the express check through, you know, at the grocery store because I can get in and out faster. And I don't have to pay attention to what, you know, I'm paying for that gallon of milk. Whereas somebody else who's on a salary, you know, they might go shopping and comparing prices of milk because they're going to get paid the same regardless. So you have to kind of figure out what your motivations are, but it really is important to focus on the main things. Like if you're really good at flipping and you're not good at renting, stop renting, flip, right? Because when you widgetize things, you do so much better. Like just by way of example, I've seen clients in the medical field that they're trying to run a medical spa. They're trying to do, you know, lasers, and then they're also doing reconstructive surgery, and they're making okay money. But the people that are doing nothing but facelifts are killing it. Why? Because they've got the system down and they're super efficient. And they're not worried about the taxes until they get, you know, really, you know, massive amounts of money. And at that point in time, then you're doing crazy stuff like insurance captives and, you know, oil and gas drilling and all that stuff to get, you know, different ways to save the money.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting. I'm not at that level, so.
Me neither.
All right, so you just touched on what's the next question here. Is it says, how should I handle an IRS audit? Is there any guidance that you can give for a person to prepare if they're selected for an audit?
Yeah. Go to your tax preparer and have them take care of it for you. They'll get the IRS agent a box of donuts and a cup of coffee and keep them happy, but you don't want to be involved if you can help it. Because a lot of IRS agents are just looking for compliance and they want to be helpful, but there are agents out there that are really looking to make your life miserable, unfortunately. And I've experienced that personally before, and I'm not saying anything bad about agents. By and large, you know, we work together. I mean, for goodness sake, we're their emissaries at some level. You know, we're the compliance officers trying to get the clients to do the right thing. But if they're fishing for something or they think something may lead to fraud or something to that effect, you really should just distance yourself from it and have your preparer or your CPA take care of that for you if at all possible.
All right.
All right. So the best path is to stay out of it.
Yes.
Leave it to
Sign
the professionals.
That power of attorney and say, here you go.
Leave it to the professionals. All right. And so the next one is what are the best practices for bookkeeping and record keeping, and any tips that you can share on maintaining accurate and compliant financial records?
That's a good question. If you're small enough and you're organized enough, having a spreadsheet is fine. A lot of people do things like QuickBooks, although, you know, a lot of these programs highly depend on how comfortable you are with the programs. I know some people that are very good with QuickBooks and other people just use them like a checkbook, and then you don't need QuickBooks at that point. Yeah. So just find whatever works best for you. We tell all of our clients this, actually. We say, look, as long as you can find a way to be organized and aggregate your information so we're not going through a shoebox having to count stuff on a billable hour, then it's going to cut your price down a good bit, and you're going to have a better idea what's going on with your situation because you're going to be more organized. And things like spreadsheets for Excel, you can do all kinds of cool things with them. They're pivot tables, all kinds of, you know, organizational opportunities that are beyond me. I have younger folks in my office doing that for me now because it's advanced so much since I started. But just whatever makes you comfortable, whatever you've been doing to keep yourself organized in the past, don't switch other things, you know, to make somebody else happy. Make sure it makes sense to you and you're doing it for yourself. And if it's something you're terrible at, hire somebody else to do it.
All right.
Okay. So now that we've talked about hiring somebody, can you give us an idea of, like, what are some average costs for hiring a bookkeeper or a CPA?
Well, once again, it's highly dependent, at least in my opinion, on your level of organization. The less source documentation you can convey to a bookkeeper or to a CPA, the less they have to go through. So the more aggregate information that you can do on your end and the cleaner you can keep your books, i.e. no commingling between personal and business stuff, the better off you are. We've got one client right now who specializes in, like, $100,000 stereo systems, like super customizable systems. And he's a super creative, but his organizational skills are horrible. And he's got 10 different credit cards that he just pulls out wherever he has credit at the time to basically, you know, make his purchases and stuff and to buy coffee for himself, you know, personal and business stuff. And then he thinks that the bookkeeper is not, like, doing their job when it's like, well, no. For us to properly capture what's going on in any of these statements you give us, we have to reconcile them. So we have to reconcile 13 different credit card statements now versus one. If you would just consolidate to one credit card and do all your business on one credit card, your costs would be 1/13 what they are.
I got to say, I'm not an angel. One time I had, and this happened to me not even a week ago, I pulled out my business debit card and paid for something at 7-Eleven. I was like, oh, shoot, why'd I do that?
That's okay, though. So the one thing that I told this other guy was, look, it's okay to do that. And in fact, a lot of times when you're starting a business up, you're going to be using just your personal credit card anyway.
Yeah.
But remember, your artificial entity or your business activity is its own cash basis activity. So what do I tell people to do? Look, you don't have enough money from the business to pay yourself back right now, and you're in business startup mode. So why don't you wait till you're making some money and reimburse yourself, yeah, right? Because in cash basis, the date of the check controls. So if you have a personal expenditure, like you had to buy a safe for your business in 2020, and you didn't have enough money to pay yourself back till 2024,
mm-hmm,
well, you take the deduction in 2024, reimbursement then.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so if you've got these personal expenses, there's two ways you can do it. You're either going to pass.
It doesn't happen very often.
Right.
It just that was a fluke.
No worries. So. No, hey, it happens all the time. I do it, and this is what I do.
Yeah.
But the two options are that non-deductible expense is going to pass through your business,
mm-hmm,
or B, you're going to reimburse yourself for that.
Okay.
And I keep a spreadsheet every month, all the miles that I drive, all the things that I buy. I buy everything personally on Amazon because I get all my points back, yeah, and then I reimburse myself at the end of the month.
I mean, we buy stuff on Amazon, too, yeah, like, you know, doorknobs, hinges.
I think everybody does.
Yeah. Yep, yeah, yeah, and just, you know, those points are free. The IRS gave up on that a long time ago, so if you've got a cash balance in your Amazon Prime credit card account, you know, that's giving you 10, 20, 30 bucks off or whatever every, you know, few weeks for the stuff that you're buying. They don't see that, and they don't care about it anymore because they tried to track it and gave up on it. So keep that free money, right? And then reimburse yourself for the other stuff that you can. Because the real goal is to keep most of your expenditures in pre-tax dollars.
Hmm. Okay. All right, next one is how can I manage cash flow effectively in my business? And any strategies you can share for improving cash flow management to ensure business stability?
So it's kind of a loaded question, but we try to get clients to make sure that they understand their business cycle, because in the medical practice context, you start over with deductibles in the beginning of every year. The weather sucks in the wintertime, and so people don't want to show up. People get sick, and you've got a bunch of things like your business license that are due in March. So you've got a lot of money going out and not a lot of money coming in. So knowing that, you should prepare to keep enough cash in your business to get you through those lean months. And I know real estate is very cyclic, but same principle. If you know what your overhead is more or less a month, it's a good idea to keep no less than 30 days worth of cash in that account just in case something happens. Because if you know you're doing real estate, I mean, and you're by yourself, I mean, what if you get hit by a truck and you're out for 3 weeks? You know, you got to think of those things.
So that's other businesses too, because I feel like January, February, March is like I'm just bleeding money everywhere, and it's like not you don't have as much coming in as you usually do.
So well, it trickles down. I mean, our business is down then too because we're expending a lot of money and time and effort getting tax returns done and getting organizers out, and we don't have any money coming in because nobody has any money to pay us. So everybody loses out during that time of the year, and we make up for it later. Well, I get a lot of folks, they panic. They're like, "Oh my gosh,
you know, I feel so bad now."
All right. Well, the first quarter was terrible. What are we going to do? You know, you extrapolate it out for the year and you think, uh-oh. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get your June financials halfway through the year and you're like, oh, we're okay.
Yeah, we're good to go now.
Yeah.
All right. So the next one is, you know, everybody wants to help out and be charitable, but not a lot of people know what are the tax benefits of charitable donations and how can I better understand how donations can impact my taxes and the documentation that's needed?
So since the Trump tax cuts were passed, and they weren't really cuts, it was offsets, you know, they raised the standard deduction and they got rid of unreimbursed business expenses as one of the offsets for that. The charitable contributions really only benefit you from a tax standpoint to the extent you itemize. And when the Trump tax cuts pretty much doubled up the standard deduction, most of us, especially with low mortgage interest rates, were unable to get to the point where you would exceed that and be able to itemize. So charitable contributions don't really, I mean, there were a couple small exceptions, but by and large, the charitable deductions don't really help you then. Because historically, when you're looking at your Schedule A expenses, which are the ones that you incur to try to see whether or not you can itemize versus keeping the standard deduction, that basically constitutes your real estate taxes paid, your car taxes paid, and your state income tax is paid, capped at $10,000 because of the Trump tax cuts. Mm. So you can't go more than $10,000, even if you have $50,000 in expenses for those. Wow. And then you tack on your mortgage interest, and you tack on your cash and non-cash charitable contributions. Most people right now aren't able to do that. Now, if you're a tither, you know, where you give away 10% of your money to charity, then that makes a difference a lot of times for folks that also have a mortgage and, you know, that kind of deal. But the documentation for the charity, the main thing is you have to have a 501c3, right? You're donating to a 501c3. You're not donating to somebody who's panhandling at a stoplight. That doesn't count. But a lot of people ask that question, believe it or not. They're like, why give it to, you know,
that's a good question.
Timmy down the street? Yeah, well, yeah. Timmy's not a 501c3.
Gotcha.
And you want to get something in writing from that 501c3 to document that for the year.
I think I'll ask that to the next panhandler who asked me for money at the traffic light.
That's right.
I'm like, are you a 501c3? What? Sorry, I can't give you any money. When you're a 501c3, let me know.
I love it. So then non-cash donations are a little bit different. I mean, it's nice to get the little, you know, Salvation Army, you know, tags or whatever.
Yeah.
But really the IRS is more liberal about that documentation than they are actual cash donations. So what I get people to do, because I'm a hoarder and my wife throws everything out, so my compromise with her was all the stuff you throw away, donate it to the Salvation Army and keep tabs on it. and we can take roughly 10 to 20 cents on the dollar for whatever the, you know, the purchase price of these things were. And even if you don't get the tag from the Salvation Army, as long as you reconstruct it, it's like an evidentiary angle on this, where there's a evidentiary rule called present sense impression, where if you write something down as it happens or reconstruct it, it can be admissible in court. And it's the same thing with the non-cash donations. Even I had almost a blackmail situation with an IRS auditor at one point in time. And for all the things that we were getting pressed on, the auditor said, hey, look, I know you don't have all your documentation for the non-cash stuff. Do a spreadsheet. Tell me, you know, who you gave it to, when you gave it to them, and how much it was, and we'll accept that. And they did.
Okay. All right. All right, so we are in an election season.
Oh, goodness.
And so, you know, based off of the front runners to be candidates for this election.
The blues and the reds.
Yeah. Who do you think has the, you know, what are your thoughts on how it will affect taxes going forward for the next 4 years? Who do you think has maybe is going to affect it the most?
Blues versus Reds.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's right now the most of the tax law changes in the current environment which we're operating are set to expire at the end of 2025. So if Trump got elected, there's a good chance a lot of those would be those deductions would be extended. Like, I remember I had told you earlier about the SALT limitation. You know, he did that because it hurt the liberal states more than anybody else, because they have higher state taxes, and so they couldn't take deductions for it. And now they finally found a workaround called the pass-through entity tax, but he would likely try to continue as much of that as he could. And historically, it's not always true, but historically, the Republicans have been more small business friendly than the liberals. So,
were liberals were better for corporate, like big corporations?
No, they all are taking money from them, you know, from big pharma and from the big corporations, that kind of deal. That's and those corporations are agnostic anyway. They just want to get what they want to get out of the deal.
Yeah.
So they're going to pay a lot of money to get whatever carve outs they get in tax favored, legislation that's going to only impact them. Remember, this is America. Everybody cares just about them and their particular angle.
Yeah.
But from a macro standpoint, the Republicans, again, historically have been more smaller government. It's a necessary evil, so they tend to take less in taxes, whereas the Democrats historically think that the government should be taking care of people, and they're willing to raise taxes to be able to kind of like Robin Hood, steal from the rich and give to the poor. But it doesn't always work out that way. And I, by the way, I think both parties should never have a candidate that can't pass an economics exam before they run for office. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, that's part of the inflation issue now. When you double up the minimum wage, what do you think is going to happen to all the other costs out there?
They're going to raise it.
Yeah. They're going to double. Yeah. And that's what's happened. So anyway.
Anyway, that's all I got, Joshua.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think we have. Is there any final closing remarks that you'd like to share?
Yeah, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, it's my first podcast ever, and I really appreciate you guys having me on. This has been a good time.
Oh, awesome.
All right, thank you.
All right, guys, if you like this video, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. Give us a like. Let us know that we're doing well. Drop a comment down below. With that, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. See you soon.